One of today's sponsors is the amazing Uni Dragon. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. Some of my personal favourite jigsaw puzzles from Uni Dragon are the Sakura, which is a gorgeous cherry blossom scene and my personal favourite, Planet Earth, which is a picturesque Earth design as seen from outer space, as well as Milky Wheels, which is a super cool design of colourful wheels. What's awesome about Uni Dragon is that all of their puzzles come in their own unique shape, as opposed to just a rectangular shape or a square shape. This makes them super fun to collect. Jigsaw puzzles really are a great way to pass the time. They're fun and they're a low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety and increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Listeners of Morbidology have a special discount code for 10% off their order on Amazon.com. Just click the link to Uni Dragon's Amazon store in my show notes and use the code Morbidology for 10% off your order on Amazon. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. It was the 15th of April, 2016, when police in Spalding, Lincolnshire, knocked on the front door of a semi-detached home on Dawson Avenue. It was the home of 49-year-old Elizabeth Edwards and her two daughters, 13-year-old Katie and 14-year-old Kim. Police were there after receiving a report that Katie and Kim had been absent from school. After receiving no response, police would break down the front door and uncover a crime scene quite unlike anything that the small community had ever experienced beforehand. Elizabeth Edwards was originally from Edinburgh, Scotland, and had worked as a dinner lady at St. Paul's Primary School, located less than a mile away from her home. Elizabeth was well known in the area because she worked in the primary school and was a very active member in the local church, where she ran drama and choir classes. Reverend Mike Chester at St. Paul's Parish Church said that Elizabeth was a very genuine and committed person. She also volunteered in the local charity shop. Reverend Chester would speak with ITV News.
She was very thoughtful. She understood how she could help people. She didn't just turn up. She was there and thinking about what was needed.
In addition to 13-year-old Katie and 14-year-old Kim, Elizabeth had an adult daughter, Mary Cottingham. Elizabeth and Peter Edwards, the father of Katie and Kim, had separated when the girls were quite young. Katie, in particular, had a very close bond with her mother. She appeared in the church production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. She did well in school and was nicknamed Cookie Monster by her best friend. She was quite quiet and shy, similar to her sister Kim, but Kim had been going through a bit of a tough time. She had been struggling with depression and self-harm. Elizabeth had been in a relationship with Graham Green for around 10 months. Each weekend, Graham would drive from his home in Rugby to spend time with her, and they always made sure to go to the Sunday service at St. Paul's Church. Graham was a truck driver and was anticipating that one day he and Elizabeth would get married. He fondly stated, "She was my rock and I was her grumpy Graham." On the 14th of April 2016, police officers showed up at the family home 3 times to conduct a welfare check. Each time, their knocks to the front door went unanswered. Then the following morning, they returned at around 9:30 a.m. and once again received no response. This time, however, they heard a dog barking from inside the home. After receiving no response, 3 police officers forced entry into the home. As they entered the master bedroom, they were met by an extremely graphic scene. Blood was spattered across the walls, floor, and bedding. Laying in the middle of the bed, they found the lifeless body of Elizabeth. She was saturated in her own blood and had a pillow covering her face. In the second bedroom of the home, they found the body of 13-year-old Katie in the same condition as her mother. In one of the bedrooms, they spotted a discarded kitchen knife stained with blood. Both Elizabeth and Katie were pronounced dead at the scene, and the welfare check swiftly transformed into a homicide investigation. By the following day, a makeshift memorial appeared outside the home on Dawson Avenue. Flowers, cards of condolences, and teddy bears piled up on the lawn outside the semi-detached home. Crime scene tapes rounded the home, and most neighbours stayed inside, not wanting to speak to the media that had congregated outside. One neighbour, who asked to remain anonymous, said that Elizabeth and Katie were such lovely people and that she had known Elizabeth for a very long time. Graham, Elizabeth's boyfriend, was completely distraught by the murders. He had been staying with friends in Derby. He posted on his Facebook, "I've been awake ages wondering what sort of day will happen today. Still lots of things are going through my mind. The lady meant the world to me. She was my rock and I was her grumpy Graham. And Katie, so young, lots of good times in front of us, has been taken away." Katie's father, Peter Edwards, also took to Facebook to share his heartache. He posted, "Katie, the kisses I will give you, I know you will feel. I will know you will feel me stroke your beautiful hair. Looking down upon me, help me find strength, the spirit you are. Kiss your mum for me. She is your mum, and for that is love. My beautiful baby, love, Dad." Peter would later purchase the adjacent plot to his daughter's grave so that he could be with her when he too passed away. Police appealed to the public, asking anybody to come forward if they knew anything about the shocking murders. DCI Martin Holvey announced that the post-mortems were being conducted and encouraged anybody who had been in the area from the 13th of April to the 15th of April to please get in contact with police and let them know if they had seen anything out of the ordinary or suspicious. However, just the following day, it would be announced that 2 teenagers, a 14-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl, had been arrested for the murders of Elizabeth and Katie. They weren't immediately identified because of their young age, but it was announced that the 2 teenagers were a couple. They appeared in Lincoln Crown Court and neither showed any emotion. They only spoke to confirm their names. During the court hearing, prosecutor Jim Clare said that they believed that the murders had taken place at the home at some point between 9:20 p.m. on the 13th of April and 12:15 p.m. on the 15th of April. He revealed that the murders had been pre-planned and pre-meditated around a week or so before they took place, and that the teenage boy was armed with weapons for himself and his girlfriend when they arrived at the home. He revealed that Elizabeth and Katie had both been stabbed to death, and that Elizabeth was stabbed first as she slept in bed, and then the teenagers went into Katie's bedroom and unleashed a frenzied attack on her too. Judge Michael Heath ordered that the 2 teenagers appear back in court for a plea hearing. With the 2 teenagers behind bars, the investigation into the murders continued. The case generated a lot of shock, fear, and upset. This type of crime was very rare for the area, and police quickly attempted to alleviate the fear generated by saying that they believed that the murders were a completely isolated incident. Since Elizabeth was quite well known in the area, it was known that she had a 14-year-old daughter, Kim. Rumours were rife that the 14-year-old girl who had been arrested was Kim. She was noticeably absent as the murders hit the headlines. But then again, rumours were also circulating that she was with her father following the murders. Superintendent Paul Timmins asked the public to not speculate about the murders or the circumstances surrounding it, adding that their utmost priority was to get to the bottom of what had happened. The two teenagers next appeared in court on the 14th of July, where Judge Justice Carr explained their proceedings to both of them, after Prosecutor Peter Joyce outlined the progress of the case. The case was adjourned until the 5th of September, when the two teenagers were to appear in Nottingham Crown Court for a plea and case management hearing. When they appeared in court in early September, they both pleaded guilty to manslaughter, but denied the charges of murder. Their plea was rejected, and the judge ordered that they both stand trial on the murder charges. The following month, however, the teenage boy pleaded guilty to two counts of murder, but the teenage girl proceeded forward to trial. Up until now, still very limited information had been released about the murders. It was known that Elizabeth and Katie had both been stabbed to death, and the two teenagers had been charged with the murders. Those two teenagers still hadn't been identified because of their ages, and no motivation had even been hinted at in the media. That would all change when the teenage girl stood trial. The trial began on the 9th of October. Prosecutor Peter Joy said during opening statements, "The killings happened within moments of each other. The mother was killed first. She was killed while Katie slept in a nearby bedroom. They were both stabbed through the throat in their beds at their home." He provided the jury with an outline of the murders. He revealed that the teenage boy had admitted to carrying out the grisly murders, but the teenage girl was claiming her defence was that her responsibility for the murders was diminished by her mental state. However, Prosecutor Joy strongly refuted this and said that it was the prosecution's belief that she was just as guilty. She was just as guilty as the teenage boy, and that she and he had planned the murders out and then carried them out together. According to Prosecutor Joyce, the teenage girl held a grudge against Elizabeth, and that the two of them decided they would kill her and her daughter. He revealed that the murders had taken place on the 13th of April, and the day beforehand the two teenagers had met up at a local McDonald's to discuss their plan. On the night of the murder, the teenage boy took four knives to the home in his backpack, as well as spare clothing. The original plan was for the teenage boy to murder Elizabeth, and for the teenage girl to murder Katie. However, both of the murders were physically carried out by the teenage boy. You're going to hear a portion of the girl's interview with investigators describing the murder.
I went into the room to see what was going on because I heard like noises and stuff. So I just wanted to check if he was okay. He was on top of her with a pillow over her head. I thought I heard her say, "Get off me."
The teenage boy had pinned Elizabeth down on her bed and stabbed her in the throat. As this was going on, the teenage girl stood outside the bedroom. She heard Elizabeth struggling and gurgling as the murder took place.
After about 10 minutes, she was dead.
When she entered the bedroom, she saw that the teenage boy had a pillow over Elizabeth's head. The stabbing had been extremely brutal and frenzied. There was blood spattered across the walls, blood on the floor, and blood on the bed. The teenage boy then checked Elizabeth's pulse and found that she was dead. He then proceeded into Katie's bedroom while the girl waited in the bathroom. Prosecutor Joy said that Katie had been smothered with a pillow, and from the position of her body, it appeared as though she had attempted to defend herself from the knife attack, but to no avail. Elizabeth had been stabbed 8 times. Her jugular vein had also been slashed so violently that the windpipe was almost severed. She had also been stabbed to the right shoulder and had cuts on her hands which indicated that she too had fought for her life. I've recently joined the new podcast app, Vodacast, and they've even sponsored this episode of Morbidology. Vodacast is a podcast app, but what sets it apart from other podcast apps is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. On Vodacast, not only can you listen to your favourite podcasts, but those episodes can come alive with supplemental digital content paired with that episode. With Vodacast, everything you want to know about that specific episode is right there on your fingertips. I know for me personally, when I finish an episode, I'll always go on Google Image the people involved in the episode and read more about the case. But with Vodacast, you don't need to do that. So click the link in my show notes or just search for Vodacast on the App Store and check it out today. The prosecutor stated that the injury sustained would not have been instantly fatal, and there was evidence that Elizabeth had survived for a short while. Katie had died from two stab wounds to the neck and smothering. After committing the murders, the teenage girl helped the teenage boy remove his blood-soaked clothing, and then the duo took a bath together to wash off any blood. Afterwards, they watched Twilight. After detailing the murders, prosecutor Joyce said, "The prosecution case is that the girl is as guilty of murder as the boy. She, together with him, planned and carried out the cold, calculated, and callous killings. She has shown no hint of remorse." He said that a relative of the teenage girl had described the combination of the two 14-year-olds as a ticking time bomb, waiting to go off. He informed the jury that the teenage girl was not denying that she was involved in the planning of the murders, or denying that she wanted the murders to be carried out. Instead, she was claiming that her mental condition at the time of the murders reduced her responsibility from murder to manslaughter. Sergeant Christopher Fletcher was the first witness to testify. He was one of the responding police officers who arrived at the family's home that morning. He detailed to the jury how they smashed through the front living room window and proceeded through the house. After finding Elizabeth dead in her bedroom, he detailed entering Katie's bedroom, which was decorated with toys. He said that he pulled out a quilt that was on top of the mattress, but it felt heavy. He knew in his heart that Katie was underneath that quilt. He said, "I was looking for Katie, who was still outstanding, hoping she was still asleep." He said that he pulled the quilt and kept shouting at Katie to wake up. He said that after pulling the quilt off, he saw the bare torso of a girl with a pillow over her face. She was cold and rigid. He described how they found six knives in the home: a long kitchen knife, a silver-handled knife, a white-handled knife, and a black-handled knife, as well as two knives that were recovered from the teenage boy's rucksack. The courtroom was then shown a 7-inch kitchen knife that was found in Katie's bedroom. DNA testing on the knife revealed that it had been used to kill Katie, and had possibly been used to kill Elizabeth as well. A second knife contained the DNA of the teenage girl and the teenage boy, and had not been used to injure either victim. It would be divulged during the trial that essentially the teenage girl had admitted to the murders. In an interview with police investigating the murder, she said that the murder plan had originally started out as a joke, but then escalated.
"I said, 'I wish I could do it.' And she said, 'Yeah.' And she thought I was joking, but I was being serious. Then she realized I was being serious, so she stopped being serious."
She said to police that she had felt like murdering people for a while, adding that her boyfriend hated seeing her upset. As she said, "It sort of just happened." She said that she had persuaded her boyfriend to take part in the murders, and then they started to seriously plan the murders. She said that a gun would have been easier, but a knife was more accessible. The couple met at McDonald's before the murder, and the teenage boy asked the teenage girl if she still wanted to go through with the murders, to which she confirmed that she did. They had decided to stab Elizabeth and Katie in their necks to try and damage their voice boxes so that they could not scream and potentially alert any neighbours. She gave a graphic description of how the murders unfolded and said that as Elizabeth was being killed, she heard her say something which sounded like, "Get off me," but she couldn't be sure because she was gurgling. During the interview, she said, "I saw her struggling with her arms. I could hear her legs kicking out and crashing onto the chair. He has claw marks on his back because she clawed him to get him off her." At one point during Elizabeth's murder, the teenage girl revealed that she saw a hand reaching out, and she thought it was her boyfriend's. She touched it and then realized that it was Elizabeth reaching out for help. She said that she instantly pulled her hand back and slowly sat down on the floor. She explained that she cradled herself in the doorway and told herself to breathe. She said that she heard Elizabeth spluttering her way through her last desperate moments on Earth, kicking out until her body finally went limp. She told the officers that after Elizabeth was dead, the teenage boy went into Katie's bedroom. She said that she waited in the bathroom as Katie was killed, but while in there, she could hear the commotion from the bedroom. She said, "I heard her say, 'Get off me,' in a scary voice, all croaky." She estimated that the murders took around 10 minutes respectively. She explained to police that after her boyfriend had carried out the murders, he seemed fine. She also told them that after the murders, they had shared a bath. As she said, "I planned it so we would be clean and refreshed and wouldn't smell of blood. We spent about 20 minutes in the bath." They then had sex and watched Twilight, adding that she was relieved that the two victims were dead. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counselling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counselling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counselling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counsellors specialising in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships. But with Podcorn, indie podcasts such as Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast, or even for finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for their podcast or advertise their brand. All you need to do is sign up to Podcorn for free and begin browsing the marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes and sign up to Podcorn today. The teenage girl also told police that she could not stand the smell of blood that had sprayed onto the walls of the bedrooms. During the interview, she said, "I was okay with it. Just the fact it happened so quickly gave me peace of mind." She also revealed that she and her boyfriend had planned on ending their own lives after the murders, and she had even left behind a note at the crime scene, which read, "Fuck you, world. I want to be cremated, and I want our ashes to be scattered at our special place. We don't give a fuck anymore." Instead of ending their own lives, however, she said that they instead had ice cream and toasted tea cakes. Dr. Indranil Chakrabarty, a psychologist specializing in children and adolescents, next told the jury that the teenage girl had first of all intended on killing both Elizabeth and Katie. In fact, she had been excited and looking forward to committing the murders, and afterwards she felt relief that they had both been killed. She had changed her mind about her personally carrying out the murders, and they decided that the teenage boy would carry them out instead. Dr. Chakrabarty testified that he believed that the teenage girl was suffering from adjustment disorder, like the defense had claimed. He said that she was unable to exercise self-control as a result of the mental illness. Under cross-examination by Prosecutor Joyce, he admitted that the teenage girl had never been diagnosed with any mental illness. The prosecutor suggested that the fact that the girl had planned the killings with the boy meant that at the time she was capable of making rational judgments. He said that this completely ruined the defense's theory. He revealed that after the murders, the couple moved a mattress downstairs and had sex on the mattress, while the bodies lay upstairs. He said that this, combined with the bath and watching Twilight, was all part of their well-thought-out plan. This doctor's testimony would be refuted by consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip Joseph. He had interviewed the teenage girl as part of an assessment. During the interview, speaking about Elizabeth, she said, "She deserved it. I'm glad she's dead." She also said that after the murders were carried out, neither she or her boyfriend felt bad about what they had done. She had revealed that Elizabeth was the main target, but Katie had been murdered to spare her the heartbreak of her mother's murder. He described the teenage girl as an intelligent teenager who was fairly engaging and quite cheerful. She had said to Dr. Joseph that everything was wrong with her, but it was his opinion that she was not suffering from any abnormality of mind at the time of the murders. Her defense team attempted to suggest that she had been suffering from an adjustment disorder, which impaired her judgment and diminished her responsibility. According to Dr. Joseph, however, he said that it was absolutely clear that she was not suffering from any sort of mental illness at the time of the murders. He stated, "Even if she was suffering from an adjustment disorder, it does not make you violent. I have never heard of a case of a planned killing as a result of an adjustment disorder." Dr. Joseph had assessed over 800 murderers and completely refuted the suggestion that the teenage girl had a mental disorder. He said that she had not expressed any remorse. He said that the teenage girl and boy had an intense and toxic relationship, and if they had never gotten together, then the murders would never have happened. He strongly believed that the teenage girl would not have committed the murders without the teenage boy. He told the jury that a group dynamic can lead someone to a course of action that they would never consider if they were on their own. It was revealed during the trial that the teenage girl had first become aware of the teenage boy when they were both in year 8, which would have been when they were 12 years old. The boy had thrown a chair across the classroom. The girl was very quiet by nature and was said to be extremely startled and disturbed by his behaviour. She told Dr. Joseph that they met through a mutual friend in May of 2015 and discovered that all three shared the same worldview, which was that life was shit and it was only going to get worse. She said that she had a major crush on the boy and was extremely jealous because she thought that the teenage boy had a crush on their friend. However, she found out that he actually had a crush on her. He asked the girl out via Facebook and she told Dr. Joseph that after they started dating, she stopped feeling suicidal and felt as though things were going good for once. She said that when they went back to school in the summer, everybody knew that they were a couple. After they were both arrested, the teenage girl said that her feelings for the teenage boy had quickly faded and she had now moved on. The murder trial lasted for 5 days. Once all of the evidence was presented, Mr. Justice Haddon Cave summed it up and said that the sole issue for the jury was whether the teenage girl was suffering from an abnormality of mental functioning at the time of the murders. The jury were then sent away to deliberate. It took them just 2.5 hours to reach a verdict. They found the teenage girl guilty of the murders of Elizabeth and Kiri. While she had not physically carried out the murders, she had been the driving force behind them. As the verdict was read out, the teenage girl sobbed softly and appeared to wipe a tear from her eye. With that verdict, the teenage couple had just become the youngest couple convicted of a double murder in Britain. The teenage couple faced indefinite detention at Her Majesty's pleasure, which was the juvenile equivalent of a life term for an adult. The sentencing phase was scheduled for the both of them the following month. Outside of court, DCI Martin Holvey issued a statement which read in part, "This tragedy was distressing for all the families involved, for Katie's school friends, for Elizabeth's colleagues, friends, and children at the school where she worked, as well as having a shocking impact on the wider community of Spalding. What makes this case even more shocking is that these two were aged just 14 when they planned and committed these callous, senseless, and unprovoked attacks on Elizabeth and Kiri. This case has left a number of lives in ruins, not only Elizabeth and Kiri's families, but also the two juveniles who committed this horrendous crime." He issued a thank you to the prosecution, partner agencies, as well as the locals of Spalding, who offered support for all of those involved. He said that family wanted him to pass on their thanks for the support and asked that they be given time and space to reflect on the outcome. Following the verdict, a serious case review was launched to investigate the interaction the teenage couple had with social workers, teachers, and other mental health specialists. Authorities were wanting to look into whether signs of deviant behaviour from the couple could have been missed in the months and years leading up to the murders. It would be revealed that the teenage girl had been known to social services since she was 6 years old, when she had been taken into care for 3 months, following an incident of domestic abuse. Following this, she had been in regular contact with mental health and social services. It would be further revealed that the teenage girl had often spoken about suicide and self-harm. Just the month before the murder, she had taken an overdose and spent a day and a half in hospital. She said that she had taken the overdose because she felt useless. The medical report from the overdose warned that she needed professional help, much sooner rather than later. The teenage girl had told mental health workers that she had felt trapped in an invisible box, and she may burst and do something really stupid. In a note, she had written, "There are times when I feel trapped, sad, lonely, depressed, and like nobody cares. I cry a lot. I've tried to remain strong, but feel like I can't go on anymore. I'm tired and alone." The teenage boy had been a troubled child who had begun acting up when he was 12 years old and was placed in separate classes for his disruptive behaviour. His mother had died of leukemia when he was 6 years old, and it had sent him into a downward spiral. He moved between foster home and rarely saw his father, who was an alcoholic from a travelling background. He then moved in with his two brothers in his aunt's house in Spalding. Here, trouble continued. The teenage boy was becoming increasingly violent and aggressive. He would punch and headbutt walls and doors and fight with his younger brother. His aunt had sought support from both children's services and from the police. When he was arrested after the murders, he made it quite clear that he hated adults. He had struggled with insecure attachment and developed deep conflicts between a need for nurturance and a fear of abandonment. After carrying out the murders, he had told the teenage girl, "I have done lesser things and I felt more bad for doing them than this." It would be further revealed that the teenage couple had been in a suicide pact with another teenage girl who was their friend. The friend said that around a week before the murders, she had a fight with the couple and the teenage boy had punched her in the face and told her to go and kill herself. She said that the three of them would often discuss self-harm, bullying and suicide. With the serious case review underway, the teenagers were back in court to be sentenced. They would both be sentenced to life in prison with a 20-year minimum term. In handing down the sentence, Mr. Justice Haddon Cave said that there had been remarkable premeditation and planning, adding that both victims were asleep in their beds, extremely vulnerable. Following the sentencing hearing, there would be much debate on whether the teenagers should be named in the media. The defense attorneys argued that both the teenage boy and the teenage girl were on suicide watch, and publicly naming them would add to that suicide risk. In most cases in the United Kingdom involving juveniles, the 1999 Act protects their identity until they reach the age of 18. The court, however, may dispense with the restriction on publication if it's in the interest of justice to do so, or if its effect would be to impose a substantial and unreasonable restriction on reporting of the proceedings, and it is in the public interest to remove or relax those restrictions. Mr. Justice Hatton Cave would ultimately decide that there was strong public interest in full and unrestricted reporting, and he ruled that the protective order could be lifted. I'm sure from just listening to the evidence presented at trial during this episode, you've already figured out who the killers were. And as the trial was documented in the media, much of the public, especially those living in the area, had figured it out. The two killers would be identified as Kim Edwards, the daughter of Elizabeth and sister of Kiri, as well as her boyfriend, Lucas Markham. To know that Elizabeth's own daughter had plotted the murders deepened the sense of disbelief and heartache in much of the nation who had followed the case in local media. After they were identified, more information about the murders would be revealed. A lot of information had been restricted beforehand. During Kim's interview with police, she had said that since she was younger, she always felt as though she didn't get on with her mother, and felt as though her mother favoured her younger sister, Kiri.
Like, really young, like, I've never got on with my mum. I knew that she favoured my sister more than me. And even though she said that she didn't, that she was lying.
She said that she was jealous of her sister, who she described as a blonde angel, and felt as though she got all the love and attention from their mother. She said that she believed if she had been allowed to see her father, then she would have been his favourite. When she said that she was happy that the murders had been carried out, she said it was because her mother wouldn't have to deal with her being suicidal anymore, and her sister wouldn't have to go through with the heartache.
Feel happy about it? My mum doesn't have to deal with me being suicidal, and she doesn't have to wake up worrying every morning to see if I'm still alive. And my sister doesn't have to go through the heartbreak and all the emotions and stuff.
While Kim had said that she didn't get on with her mother, their Facebook accounts would never have given off that impression. Just the week before Elizabeth was murdered, she had commented on a photograph of Kim. "Where's your beautiful smile, X?" To which Kim replied, "I don't know, X," followed by a number of emojis. Elizabeth replied, "I think it's under your bed, lol, X," which was posted with a cartoon image of animals sleeping. However, back when Kim was a young girl, she had watched her mother suffer domestic abuse at the hands of her father, who was described in court as an abusive drug addict. When she was 6 years old, she became known to social services, when Elizabeth punched Kim in the face and then referred herself to social services. For 4 months, Kim and Katie had lived with a foster family before being returned to Elizabeth. It would further be revealed that on the night of the murder, Kim had opened the bathroom window of the family's home for Lucas to sneak in.
And what happens this time?
She looks out the window, sees me there. Yeah. She waves, I put my thumbs up, and then she goes to the bathroom window.
Okay, and what happens then?
She opens the bathroom window, I pass my bag through, I get through, and then she opens my bag. I take a knife out, and I pass her a knife. She holds the knife, but never used the knife.
Lucas had described the murder to investigators in chilling detail.
I went into her mum's room. Stabbed her in the neck where she was asleep on her side and smothered her face with a pillow.
Why? What was the reason for killing Katie?
Because she had called the police.
Okay. Is that the only reason?
Pretty much. I went into Katie's room, which is the same room as Kim's, and I thought I stabbed her, but I'm not 100% sure if it was like her or the mattress. And then I smothered her face with a pillow too.
What conversation takes place then?
She asked if she struggled to get it, and I said no. And, like, if it happened, and I said yeah. That was pretty much it. Then she said, take your clothes off because they're covered in blood, and I did. Then we put them in Liz's room, and then we ran a bath, had a bath together, just because we were both dirty.
When Elizabeth found out that Kim and Lucas were dating, she had worried because she felt as though Lucas could be a bad influence on her daughter. He was a troublemaker and had been expelled from school. She had tried to keep them apart, but it was her displeasure of their relationship that had driven them even closer. A week before the murders, the couple had barricaded themselves in his bedroom and had refused to come out after Elizabeth and Kim got into an argument about Kim seeing her father. When Kim returned home from Lucas's home, she found that Elizabeth had bagged up some possessions from her bedroom and had given some to Katie. Elizabeth told Kim that she was scared that she was going to end up like her father. Kim said that it was evident that she did not belong in the family anymore, and it was that weekend that they started to plan the murders. Lucas had actually told fellow classmates that he wanted to murder Elizabeth, but nobody ever believed in a million years that he was being serious. His school friend, Adam Free, said that Lucas was strongly influenced by Kim and would have done anything she ever asked. He also said that Lucas was obsessed with the murder of Adam's father, Warren Free, who was murdered just streets away from where Elizabeth and Katie were killed in August of 2014. Adam would speak with Crime and Investigation about this.
When I was 13, my father was murdered at home. There was a bunch of kids kicking down our fence, which then escalated into murder. Lucas was, in particular, like one of those people who wanted to know about a lot of what happened, questioning what happened, wondering like how I was, and you know, asked what's going on with the court and that, and what the interviews were about. He wanted to know like the entire process of what was going on at times.
A group of teenagers would stand trial for that murder, but they were all acquitted. Warren's family believed that Lucas may have felt emboldened by the murder, because nobody was ever convicted of it. After committing the murders, the couple had stayed inside the home, and when police broke in, they found them on a mattress on the living room floor. Kim was asked where her mother was, to which she replied, upstairs. She was then asked what happened, to which Lucas sarcastically replied, why don't you go up and see? The sentences of Kim and Lucas would later be reduced from a minimum of 20 years to a minimum of 17 and a half years, meaning that when they are 32 years old, they will both have a shot at parole. The murders of Elizabeth and Katie Edwards were the culmination of an obsessive teenage romance between two very troubled teenagers who felt as though the world had done them wrong. They were both so hermetically sealed in their own world of selfishness that nothing mattered except for themselves, not even the lives of two innocent people, one of whom was just a child. The murders had completely transfixed the nation, even more so when it was revealed that one of the killers had been Elizabeth's own daughter and Katie's own sister. Well guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Elizabeth, Ashley, Chantel, and Melissa. I'm eternally grateful for your support. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, ad-free, early release episodes, behind the scenes, and much more. For those who didn't know, I'm going to be at CrimeCon in London in September of this year. I'd love to see some of you guys there. Listeners of Morbidology get 10% off their ticket at crimecon.co.uk with promo code MORBID. It's going to be super fun with lots of awesome guests. And we're having a true crime quiz on the Saturday night too. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, A Few Bad Apples. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Police departments around the country are notorious for turning a blind eye towards officers who have committed serious offenses. I'm Catherine Sheffield, the host of A Few Bad Apples, a weekly podcast that takes listeners into deep dives of crimes committed by bad apple officers. Not all policemen are bad, and in fact, I highlight a positive story at the end of every episode. Sharing these victim stories is my way to provoke change within police departments. A Few Bad Apples is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.